And we are back, Bostopian News with Evan George, and I'm very happy to be joined with two students from Northeastern, members of Huskies for a Free Palestine, Celsine and Patricio. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
And I don't think this needs too much of an introduction. I think one of the largest stories going on in the world right now is both the expression of solidarity with Palestine across US campuses and the violent militaristic police crackdown on those protests. And before we discuss all that and the events that occurred at Northeastern, could you both just go into a little detail about how you became members of Huskies for a Free Palestine and what the goal of that organization is?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to preface that, we're not necessarily members of any kind of organization or like a fixed group. I think for me personally, as a student with roots in the Global South, I'm just always going to be aligned with any kind of group or any students, any cause that's fighting for liberation and fighting for a better future. And I think the group that came together at Northeastern is very organic, and people come and go, and yeah.
Great. And is this same with you, Celsine? Did you get involved with this because of this specific action, or were you organizing with this group before?
I was never directly organizing with them. It was very much of a like organic thing. Like they would do a lot of like teach-ins, and they would do a lot of like rallies and flyering and just like, I think if you're on any social media or like watching anything happening in the world, you'd know what's happening with Palestine. So it's kind of hard to like not want to get involved in some capacity. So I just kind of sought them out when they were doing like teach-ins and flyering. So tabling as well. And then eventually, since I follow them on Instagram, we heard about the encampment and I was there.
Great. And I know from an Instagram post that they sent out, because I've also been following them, just trying to keep abreast of what's been going on in Boston. Their three demands: disclose, divest, and denounce. And similar to most college campuses, they are focusing on the endowment of their universities and how those investments are made. Are either one of you able to speak on like Northeastern's endowment in and of itself and what this demand to disclose and divest means?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Northeastern as like a private institution, the biggest just at the surface seems to be disclosed, because they are very shadowy and very careful about hiding where exactly their money is going. And as a result of past HFP actions, they released really a quite I think disturbing statement, trying to argue that their endowment and their investments were non-political. And kind of in the worst kind of tone, saying that politically active students should not try and make this a political issue or something, as if fighting against genocide is some absurd or indecent kind of action, and as if an endowment which has billions of dollars or millions of dollars in companies like Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and Boeing, and there's co-ops at these companies, there's students who are studying and working at these companies, is something somehow not political.
I can only imagine how infuriating it must be, being students and having your university professors or the presidents of the colleges speak to you as if you don't understand how the real world works. And then, oh no, money's not political. You shouldn't be focusing on money. Don't worry about any of that or investments or where the money goes. That's not po politics. I'm sure it's maddening, but and I think Northeastern has roughly, I think it's over a $1.5 billion endowment. It's not like the massive hedge fund that Harvard has, but that is still a serious amount of money. And as you were saying, as Northeastern prides itself on its co-op program, and they're having their students do co-ops in these companies that are directly complicit in the war machine that is currently carrying out a genocide. And has there been any direct action is not the right word, but trying to get students themselves to not go along with these co-ops? Or is this more part of like an overall umbrella of demands that we want the university itself to break off its ties?
Definitely, it's been like the university breaking off ties first. Just because I think they're the ones directly responsible for a lot of it. They're the ones who like present the opportunities and not just present the opportunities themselves, but like definitely push students to like go on those co-ops. And like it's not a coincidence that those co-ops pay the most. They often pay more than like humanities or like nonprofits ones, and like that's just kind of a reality in like every university. But the fact that it's specifically like with Raytheon and like those type of companies is, you know, I feel like really not a coincidence. So we're like, it's more I think of a push for the university to do better as opposed to like students, but also students should be doing better.
Yeah, and I think if I can just highlight that student mobilization at Northeastern is not new whatsoever. And this issue, the issue of global empire and the issue of European genocide against Black and Brown peoples across the globe is not new. And students have been aware of this for a while. So there's a previous campaign from the Progressive Student Alliance at Northeastern that attacked these same companies and their ties at Northeastern. And this is all before October, and you know, was an end to co-ops and trying to get students to protest against this. And I think the narrative from the university is that all of this is like some kind of brand new issue, and the outside instigators are coming in, and it's like, no, there's a long history of students at Northeastern being fed up with their university being complicit in these very violent ties.
That's a great point. Northeastern itself has had a lot of great student organizations over the years fighting against Northeastern. I'm sure it is a little bit like before your time in terms of your relationship with the university. I think it was back in 2016, there was a major lawsuit about Northeastern basically illegally expanding in the area.
Yeah,
And, you know, a lot
Roxbury.
has been made about just like the space that these colleges and universities take up. I think NYU and Columbia are like the largest landholders in Manhattan. Harvard owns roughly 30% of Alston Brighton, and Northeastern, I think it's over like 75 acres of land in what is predominantly a poorer minority area of Roxbury. And I think even a little bit more recently, Northeastern having a contract with ICE. And this was when, you know, for a lot of at least liberals, it was a big deal that ICE's involvement, that's somewhat gone by the wayside. But I just wanted to further highlight just like the history of Northeastern student organizations. And I think now we can maybe start transitioning to the encampment itself. And you went into a little bit about how you found out, but can you just walk us through when you first found out about the encampment and when you made the decision to join it?
Well, I found out about the encampment through social media. They were asking people to get there early just because, you know, there's safety in numbers. So the more people that are there in the beginning, the safer it is. And they at first there was only like 30 people in the encampment. And we can get into that later. But yeah, that's how I found out about it. It was just a call for like community support. And like they also offered up roles for the community to like take on. So it's like if you had like some ties to like get supplies, or if you had the ability to like make food for people or get food for people. And I like to cook a lot. So that was like the community role I took on, was to like cook for the people.
Yeah, and I think I can speak to kind of more about the organizing behind it because obviously this was all publicized as Huskies for a Free Palestine, but I think in the build up to it and the group that was on the ground right at the very start tried to keep things under wraps and out of admin's hands, but obviously that wasn't successful and there were police on the ground from the very first minute, very high police and aggressive police presence, but that group itself was, you know, in through word of mouth and through back channels, you know, so trying to keep things under wraps, but it was a broad-based group of students, not just from, you know, not just students who had connections with Huskies for Free Palestine, but students from YDSA, students from the Progressive Student Alliance, which I just mentioned, students involved in organizing with labor, members of magazines, just a broad base of students who were there right at the very first moment, and to start this encampment. And I think also from the very first moment, the intention was to open up what is a very elitist, racist, classist institution that maintains these hard borders with its surrounding communities, to say no to the ID policy, to say no to admin who want to maintain these borders, and to have the community come in. And that was probably the most successful thing from the first minute, and for the whole camp.
And for clarification, can you discuss what that ID policy is?
Yeah, I mean that's kind of a shadowy thing about Northeastern, which is that it prides itself on being an open campus, but it's all private property. And the moment you stray from admin's best interests, they will attack you. So if you look at the police log, it's unhoused individuals, you know, surrounding community members being racially profiled, being attacked for, you know, it's calls for people suspected of squatting, and it's just a tremendous amount of violence against the surrounding community. And so whenever, you know, anyone tries to protest or have a rally, suddenly this open campus becomes a campus where if you don't show ID, you are trespassing. You're subject to quite a tremendous amount of police violence. And we wanted to highlight that immediately. And I think that was very successful.
And that's normally a ploy that a lot of universities and major developers do, is they, you know, pitch like, you know, let us have this space. We're going to put parks, playgrounds. It's all going to be open to the public. And as you said, it's open until it isn't, until we actually are the arbiters of now we're going to close that gate. Even though, again, we sold the local community on open access indefinitely. And I don't want to go too much into the specifics of both of your roles within the encampment, because, and I don't think we've mentioned this yet, one of you was arrested. You're doing a lot of court solidarity. It's generally my role of, if you are currently going through the legal system, you should give as much public details as possible. And so I definitely don't want you to say anything that you feel might be used against you in any way. But Celcine, you talked about how you did a lot of cooking for this. Patricio, did you have a role? Were you there as just a member? And could you both maybe speak to, you know, like, did you never leave the encampment? Is it, were people coming and going? What was your overall experience in the few days leading up to the raid on the encampment itself?
Do you want to talk about like what your role was?
I think I was there. I think people were coming and going by and large, and I was there fairly continually, barring a few hours, getting supplies, getting some rest. And I think just being there was the biggest kind of, just being there and being available to help, but also just to witness was kind of the most important thing for me, regardless of any role.
Could you talk about, you know, like, what did it look like? What did it sound like? What were some of the activities? Mm-hmm. I got to go to the Emerson encampment briefly before I covered the raid that happened. And, you know, just like the amount of life and like you know, just that way of how much lively their encampment was. And, you know, seeing videos, it seems it was similar. But overall, what was the encampment like? What was the experience?
Honestly, and that was like the best, I think, time that a lot of people had at the Northeastern campus, because in Northeastern, because of like the co-op aspect to it, a lot of people feel like there's not a lot of community in Northeastern. Like, it's very hard to like keep a consistent community because people go on co-ops, they come back and they're like in different classes at this point. And just like in general too, just the way Northeastern is set up, like even though it's a very like big public campus, like there's not a lot of like community spaces to gather. Like its architecture is just really like menacing in that way. So I think like Centennial being like the biggest green space on campus and like the main green space on campus, and then us like taking over it and like making it ours was a very powerful thing that a lot of people like didn't even would come into the camp and didn't even really know a lot about like what was happening in Palestine, what was happening in Gaza. They just saw that there was community space and that everyone was so welcoming. And then people would start getting like more informed on the camp itself. And there was literature there. There was like books and like zines that people could read and like get more informed on. So it was definitely like the first space in Northeastern where like I feel like a lot of people, and I heard this from a lot of people because I was there pretty often, that was the first space where they felt like they actually had like a Northeastern community, like they could like confidently say that there was a Northeastern community. So I think that was very special. I know since the beginning we had a lot of programming for like teach-ins and like cultural dances and speakers and just like giving people something to do. We had like bands come in, like little independent bands from school. So there's a lot of music. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of care, genuine care. And we had a bunch of things lined up. And then the first day, Northeastern just came and like we did not have a single like hour or 2 hours where there wasn't 3-4 cops watching us at all times. And the way Centennial is like set up is like it's a very open space. So cops could see you from everywhere. There was like cops on buildings, like surveilling us. So that made the space a little bit harder to just like relax. Like definitely people were on edge at points because Northeastern Police has a very like has a record of being really aggressive with its students. So that yeah, I think a lot of people just like couldn't, there was times where people couldn't like calm down, but like when people could, there was like we had, I was in charge of like food and stuff. Like I cooked big meals for like the encampment. There's a lot of people, but people ate, and then other people came and they brought their, once they saw that people were like we were accepting hot meals, people were like, oh, like I'll be right back, like I'll go cook something in my kitchen really quick and I'll bring it over. People were, you know, sometimes people would have like a little bit of like anxiety and like just like really worried about like the police presence because, you know, people's traumas are just different with like police. And we kind of like, it wasn't even on purpose, but we had one tent where it was like, okay, people go into this tent when they have like an anxiety attack, and we bring them food and we bring them like water and we try to calm them down. So it was a lot of community care right off the bat. Like everyone really stepped up. And I think that was something I was really proud of my community for doing because as one of the like first people there, like I was really like kind of stressed out about like, oh, like what if they don't have enough food and they don't know where to get the food? But people are very self-sufficient, especially when they know that like their community has trust in them. And I think that's what played a really big part in the encampment, was that we all had trust in each other. It's like we might have never met each other, but we're both here for the same cause. And if something goes down, I know that you have my back and I have yours.
And it's odd that, you know, the encampments themselves is basically what colleges try to build the college experience to be like. Like, oh, you're gonna meet all these interesting people, have these great conversations, there'll be literature, you'll have community. Now, most people's college experience is nothing like that. You enter into little silos. I went to a private military school, so mine was definitely much different than that. But, you know, you all through this encampments actually got that experience that Northeastern pretends it gives its students. And it just I don't know, paradoxical that it's then the administration trying to stop it. And so in the lead up of the eventual police raid, what was the communication? And I know that because it's like a large community, you might not be able to speak to necessarily the most up-to-date specifics to it, but what was the relationship like with the administration and the encampment ahead of the raid? Was there a constant dialogue? Were both parties giving demands to one another? What was that like?
Yeah, I think we have experience negotiating with admin at Northeastern, and admin at Northeastern are especially slimy, and the whole institution of Northeastern University is kind of geared towards protecting its bottom line, protecting its public image, its prestige. And throughout all of this, it has been completely opposed to even addressing its complicity in the genocide of the Palestinian people, as we discussed earlier. So our intentions going into this was simply that the demands, the three demands, to disclose, divest, and denounce were going to be the starting point, and there would be no outside negotiations outside of the demands. And I think by and large, our communication with admin was their presence, basically hand in hand with the police, from the first minute. So just a complete unwillingness to recognize any sort of wrongdoing, any sort of accountability with regards to what was at the start of this day 201 of the most well-documented genocide in human history against the Palestinian people. As we said, it's from the first minute just an intention of using violence to remove student protesters from the very first minute. And I think, as Zeltin said, there was not a moment where the camp was not under some amount of police presence. And I think that's very unique to Northeastern compared to the other camps, to Northeastern's unwillingness to even recognize its complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians. There were always police present. And if they weren't visible, they were behind, you know, in a building or in a parking lot, in pretty considerable numbers. There were always police present. And the first day was notable because it was, as Zeltin said, there was our programming started very late because the first 8 hours were direct confrontation with the police, who were simply trying to squash anything, to remove us completely, to have nothing be present.
And I think, as you said, really the great tactic that you all use, and by you all, I mean the university students, is getting as many numbers as quickly as possible there. You know, mm-hmm. as Helsine said, it's much easier mm-hmm. if just a couple people, like, you know, you're waiting for more to join. Police are going to be able to push people around in that. Mm-hmm. If you have, you know, you form up a large amount of people and then you storm it, it makes it a lot more daunting, a lot less. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, odd listening to you describe this back and forth with the administration, because it seems like it would have been such an easy ask for them to do things like disclose, or even if they wanted to be slimy about it and say, okay, let's trick these students. Let's say we're going to agree. We're going to write a statement that we'll publish. We're going to work with you on a statement, you know, and just draw it out for weeks. Let's talk about what this statement is. We've talked to our hedge fund. They're going to give a report. There's going to be a report by the end of the school year. They could have just lied, essentially, or they mm-hmm. could have just complied. But it seems like from the get-go, it was, there was no negotiation. Get off mm-hmm. the lawn and get back mm-hmm. into your dorms. And mm-hmm. I think now that kind of gets us to the police response in the raid. And if you could help me with the date too, because I know it went like late into the night, then I think the actual police clearing was early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so what was that night like, where there was this big buildup? You know, there was a raid on Emerson, I think the day or the 2 days before. And now it looks like there's an oncoming raid. What did the encampment feel like over that night? What did it look like? And then if you can talk about what you saw during the police raid that next morning.
The first night or the second night, do you want?
The night that eventually resulted in the police clearing the encampment the following morning.
Yeah. Friday night. I think the people that were on the ground all the time, like, we went into this knowing that there was going to be clash with NUPD. Like, NUPD, like, in the rallies that we've had, in the teach-ins, in the sit-ins, in the die-ins that we've had, have always just been really aggressive with every student ever. So we already knew, and knowing what happened at Emerson, because a lot of us did go to Emerson to like support in whatever way we could. And like, we had supplies and I think kind of going back a little bit, like being a witness is a really important role. Like, even if you're not directly in the camp, but just being around the camp is super important. And like, it's like a really low risk, like, action you can take. And it still helps immensely, because the last thing these like universities want is bad publicity. And like, videos of them like dragging out their kids from their own campus. So we also went to like Emerson to be witnesses, and then it was kind of crazy, because I was at Emerson and just being a witness, and then I went home, and then we just heard word that they were raided, and that they were raided like very brutally and aggressively. Definitely everyone was already on edge at Northeastern, like, especially during the night, because we knew that was probably when they were going to move in, just because numbers dwindle down around those hours. So I kind of forgot where I was going with this.
No, that's all useful. And then Patricio, what was it like for you that night, and what did you experience once they eventually cleared it out that following morning?
I think like I said, it was from minute one of an incredible amount of police violence. And also from minute one, I think our unwavering solidarity with the Palestinian people, with the Palestinian resistance. And it was all very special, because we were able to create this space that celebrated that solidarity. And that was built into the very roots of the camp. And it was a constant resistance against the police presence. So by Friday night, we had received information that a worker for Olympia Moving had been called into to shift at 3 a.m. And then obviously admin had sent their fun little message to the media that they had a game plan for that night. And then also just, we know Northeastern, we know what their, as I said, their prestige, their bottom line, their complete unwillingness to recognize their complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians. So we said, you know, Monday graduation, commencement, ceremonies begin. Over the weekend, the community, our allies, our people will be in numbers. Admin are going to try and get us out by Friday night. This is their strategy. And I think I think there was fear and there was panic and there was paranoia. But more than anything, there was that we rallied. We kept each other safe, and that was like, who keeps us safe? Like, we keep each other safe. And when it came down to it, at 4 or 5 a.m. and when we were pretty certain that police were going to move in, there was just an absurd amount of state troopers parked nearby. It was, once again, people arm in arm, students, unarmed students, peaceful students, simply speaking out against mass atrocity, speaking out against genocide, chanting. The chant was like, show me what community looks like. This is what community looks like. Show me what resistance looks like. This is what resistance looks like. We were gonna hold our camp. We were gonna speak our truth, that we were not gonna be complicit in the genocide of the Palestinian people.
And I think to like speak on that, like as being arrested, like I was locked arms with like people for a very long time. We were like very much like sleep deprived and like hungry, and we were up for a lot of hours at that point when the state troopers moved in. But this might be really weird to say, but like in that moment, I really did not feel any fear. Like everything was gonna be okay. Like it was just like that, like my community was with me and my friends were watching me from like outside the barricades, and it was like everything will be okay, because at the end of the day, there's no way like fighting for the right thing can lead to something so bad. Like you just, I think everyone in their hearts of hearts when they were in that encampment and like state troopers were moving in and like surrounding us and facing us off, everyone knew that like this is the right side, like we are on the right side, and all your fear just goes away because you're in community. Like I didn't feel any fear going into Shomen. I didn't feel any fear like in the paddy wagon. I didn't feel any fear when we were in the jail. Like it was just community. And it's like, I think that's why they've been attacking people with so much like aggressive force. And because it's like, there doesn't seem to be fear once you're in community.
And I think that's like a great point. It's like a strength and beauty in that action in and of itself that you can't feel anywhere else. And I think that's one of the powers that these encampments had, is that, now there's an entire generation of people who know what that feels like. And the violent reaction is almost the self-awareness that they don't feel that. And they feel the opposite of that. And that is one of the reasons that they react so violently and with so much hate, is that they don't have that feeling.
I think that's a really good point. Like it is like a weird form of like being so self-aware that they don't have that bravery, because it's like they're realizing like students in like one of the most prestigious schools, like we live a very comfortable life as like U.S. students, and like in these schools, like we have our problems with our universities, but in retrospect to like what's happening in Palestine and Gaza, like there being no universities left, like we live a very comfortable life here. And I think it makes them very worried that we care this much about people who are like so far away from us. But, it's that chant, like in the hundreds and the thousands, we're all Palestinian. And I think we all really did feel that in the encampment and when we were like facing off the police.
And I think what also additionally terrifies them is your all's ability to connect things like the economics of the university and this atrocity, and why the administration, we discussed this earlier, was so early to be like, no, like don't focus on money, that's not politics, keep that mentally separate. Politics is, do you have the right to vote or not, and that's all politics is. Don't worry about money and how it's connected, stay away from that. And since the mass arrests, there's been some, I'll call them lies, coming out of the administration, but since you both were there, you can clarify it. One of which was from a statement that was read, I think sent to, and I'm just going to bring it up so I can read it to you both, though I'm sure you've seen it, sent to a reporter, Tori Bedford, who's been doing a great job covering this, and, was asked about someone yelling, kill the Jews, and the university saying that, that was it. Once that remark was made, this was the decision. And I'll just read for you this quote here. And this is, again, is an email from the Vice President of Communications, Northeastern University, Renata. The fact that the phrase kill the Jews was shouted on our campus is not in dispute. The Boston Globe, a trusted news organization, reported it as fact. There is also substantial video evidence. Any suggestion that repulsive anti-Semitic comments are sometimes acceptable depending on the context is reprehensible. That language has no place on any university campus. So who yelled that statement that ended up giving, you know, the cause bella for this police raid?
I mean, I was there. I was there on that night, and it was Zionist counter-protesters. I could say that very, very clearly. And then also I can give my own testament of the moment, my own witnessing, because I don't think I heard a single insult from within the camp over the whole 48 hours. As we've said so plainly, it was such a beautiful and a beautiful moment of community and something so rare for Northeastern's campus. That made the dissonance with the individuals who came up to the camp that night so, so striking, because all they were saying were insults. Insults and hatred and vitriol, attempting to instigate some kind of violence. I think all of my comrades who were there can attest to that. Tori Bedford can attest to that. It's on video, obviously, thankfully. And I think I would like to highlight that that hateful phrase is absolutely condemnable and should not be repeated in any context. I think it highlights how anti-Zionism is a liberatory practice when you look at how much true anti-Semitism has been disseminated and repeated and propagated and made so public and by the university's defense of Zionism, by the defense of Zionism. So we had a Jewish pro-Palestine organizer arrested very forcefully on the first day of the encampment, singled out, held with a knee to his back, strip searched unlike any other arrested person. And then we had, obviously, these individuals, and this was not the only instance where they were attacking the camp and repeating these hateful words. And whenever they saw any one of my Jewish comrades within the encampment, they would deny their Jewishness. And my Jewish comrades will tell you that is anti-Semitism. And in the aftermath of the camp, this phrase has had more airtime than it would ever have had because of Zionist counter-protesters, because of the hate that is Zionism. And that's just my point. And my Jewish comrades can speak better than I ever could. But that is just anti-Zionism. Our anti-Zionism is a liberatory practice, and it generates community and love. And our fight is the fight for life, the fight for liberation.
And another headline that I've been seeing about this event, and I think Fox News had a whole article about it, was that these were all outside agitators, that the majority of people arrested during this raid at Northeastern weren't even students. See, like, there are these professional protesters, so on and so forth. Could you both speak to that point? And, you know, you can address it any way you would like.
Yeah, I don't mean to laugh, but like, professional like protesters, I don't even, like, what does that even really mean? We're like, the thing is, like Patricio already said, is like, Northeastern loves to play this game where it's like, oh, we're an open campus and we're like at the heart of Boston and we're like so part of this community, and as soon as any community steps in for a community event, it's like, oh, you guys are outside agitators and you guys are professional protesters. And a lot of those quote unquote professional protesters were like 18-year-old kids from Mass R or BU who also like wanted to come to our encampment because they saw that, you know, it was happening maybe at their school and they wanted to come see ours. Like, I think a phrase that is really like true to my generation, and I think it just shows our character, is that it's encampment hopping. So a lot of kids were just encampment hopping, and so when they say professional like protesters or outside agitators, it's just really hard, because it's really hard to like imagine what they even mean. Because when I was arrested, like, there was two 18-year-old girls from Mass Art right next to me, and I was like, these are just, these are just kids who know what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah, and you know, that was somewhat of a leading question, but I also knew that, you know, that statistic that they're running with was mostly because, as you were saying, it was other students joining, just like yourself, you know, would attend the Emerson in solidarity. Mm-hmm. And those sort of events have a gravitational pull to them for mm-hmm. a lot of the reasons we've been discussing, because of that love in that community. And so students who might not have their own encampment 18, 19, 20 year olds, they want to be part of that and they want to join in solidarity. Mm-hmm. And I think the last thing that I heard coming from the administration was that no Northeastern students were arrested. If you showed your ID, they let you go. Now, your own experience seems to contradict that, but can you speak to that also?
For sure. So my experience, and I don't know like what you do with like trigger warnings or anything, but I did have like a really specific like experience with the police in Shulman Hall. They went around telling us that first it was not Northeastern admin that told us this. It was the police. And we know that police are legally allowed to lie to you. So it was really hard to believe anything that they were saying, especially when they were facing us off and like attacking my comrades. So they kept going around being like, you know, the university hears you. If you are a Northeastern student and you show your ID, you're allowed to leave. You won't get arrested. I wasn't just going to leave like other students that came from all over the place. There were some students that came from Jersey, like New Jersey and New York, to our encampment. So I was like, I'm not just going to abandon them here. And then they said they threatened us with expulsion if we were Northeastern students. But again, like there was two 18-year-old girls like right next to me and I was not going to leave them there. So, and it was just, again, it was like, it went back to that solidarity of showing no ID, because it's like, if they're not going to show ID, I'm not going to show ID and just like take the easy way out. And that was a lie, because a lot of the Northeastern kids, like not a lot, but like two, I think Northeastern kids showed their ID, to try and leave, because it is a very scary thing, especially if you're like first gen or like you're on a lot of financial aid that Northeastern provides, to be like, okay, now you're going to get expelled and your financial aid will be taken away. Cause that is something they threatened us with. So it's fair, like when two of like my Northeastern comrades left, that they just, you know, but then they still got arrested. So that was like, they were just trying to bait us out. I think what they were trying to do was like make the circle smaller, so they didn't have as many to arrest. We walked into Shulman and they kept telling us, they kept baiting us into showing us our Northeastern ID. They're like, if you show your Northeastern ID, you won't get arrested. And I didn't show my ID until we were actually in the Shulman classroom. And I had my inhaler inside my shirt and my ID. And I was like, I can show you my ID. Because at this point, they knew I was a Northeastern student. I think they overheard me talking to someone else. So they were kind of grilling me a lot more. They're like, if you show your ID, you won't get expelled. Like, you might still get processed, but you won't get expelled and you won't get suspended. Arrested. No, they said that, like, I would still get, like, processed and arrested, but I wouldn't get expelled or suspended. So I was like, okay, I'd rather just, like, if I can, like, avoid being suspended or, like, being expelled, then that's, I'd rather that. So I was going to show them my ID, and I had my hands zip tied behind my back, and I saw them take one zip ties off of someone else, and I asked them if they could take my zip ties off, because I had my ID and my inhaler inside my shirt. And they said no, that they couldn't do that. And that a female officer would search me. And I, like, the female officer, I was like, please, like, there's like male officers like right behind you. Like, if you lift up my shirt, like, there's no way someone will not see something. And I was in a room full of my comrades and students, and my back, thankfully, was like turned to everyone else, so no one else saw, but like there was two male officers right in front of me, and she lifted up my shirt to try and find my inhaler and like my ID, and she couldn't find it for a while, and she made this really weird comment where she was like, oh, I feel like I'm assaulting you, I'm sorry. And I was like, you definitely are. So I asked you, and I like said that I would comply and I would take all of my stuff out, and you aren't allowing me to do that. And yeah, so that was something that also happened, because that I was trying to show my ID so I wouldn't get expelled or suspended, but obviously that was a lie, because there's probably going to be like disciplinary like actions against the Northeastern kids who were arrested.
And sorry. All right. I'm very sorry that happened to you.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of leads us to now, like where things are at now. As you were saying, you had a court date yesterday. I think we were discussing this before we went officially live with the recording, but they're just like processing like dozens at a time because there are now hundreds of students across Boston. And so where do things currently sit, both the legal aspect and also with the administration? Like, what are they communicating to the students that participated in this encampment?
So far, there hasn't been any actual like email that we've gotten or any word from them. The theory that we kind of just been circling around each other is that they just notoriously take a really long time with these type of stuff, but also they might be trying to wait out like the heat, so they don't hear like there's no more backlash when they do like email us or contact us with like disciplinary charges.
That's also my guess, is they're just waiting for the clock to run out. You know, summer's approaching, students will be leaving campus, you know, attack once everyone's separate, everyone's going to be all over the country, because if they do really say anything, it's going to be bad. And there's a lot of people have that connection there. They're going to use it. I'm just going to briefly shut this window so you don't have to hear the garbage going. Let's see how well I remember to edit that part out. But yes, it does seem like that is going to be the strategy. And that was really another thing. And I don't, you've been both been very generous with your time, that I found, again, so odd about the administration reaction, not just with you, but also with Emerson, was you could wait this out. Summer is coming. There was no logical reason why you needed to storm to have these images. And for some reason, they chose to, I think, for many of the reasons we've already discussed. And I guess my last question for you is, there's been a lot of comparisons, rightfully so, about these actions, your actions, and the anti-Vietnam protests in the 1960s. And something that I always find maddening is that the universities now fundraise and market off of those protests. And they sell it to students saying, look, you can be part of these civil actions. Now they themselves are carrying out that same brutality against you all. And I have every bit of confidence that in 20, 30 years from now, they will be using your images as part of their promotional tools to get new students to lie to them, essentially, about like, look at how intelligent and beautiful our students are. Yeah. How does that not drive you insane, both knowing how they're talking to you now and how they'll probably use this in the future?
It does drive us insane, because they will use our pictures. I have no doubt about us being so brave and so courageous and so smart. And that we are, but not, I don't want it to be used as their PR, but it is just really frustrating, because it's like, they were the ones who allowed the strip search to happen for my other comrade. They were the ones who allowed like, for like other bodies to be violated, just like mine. They were the ones who allowed like aggressive force against my other friends. Like, they allowed that. Like, it's super maddening, because they're going to eventually like try and turn this around like in their favor. But I really hope that like everyone takes away is like, at the end of the day, this is for Palestine, and it is for Gaza. This is not about the university, and you should always be super critical of your university, regardless of where you're at, because they're just their funding and they're like, I kind of lost it, but yeah.
I mean, I think the biggest thing is that we're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. No one is going anywhere. No one is done, because Palestine is not free. Mm-hmm. And they're very afraid, and they're very, very, very anxiously trying to get to that point where they can present a sanitized image and continue on business as usual, continue on living normally. And I think it's on us as students, as the next generation, on the, you know, there were high schoolers at the encampment from Boston Latin, also fighting for Palestine, fighting for liberation. So it's on our generation, on the next generation, on everyone who, because of the actions that are occurring, are able to see how interlocked all of our struggles are, to continue fighting. And I think if you keep shouting, if you keep struggling, if you keep bringing up the genocide against the Palestinians, if you ensure that no one ever forgets what the last few months have done, who was silent over the last few months, then things can never be fully repaired, because I think it was this anxious and terrified desire on the part of the administration. Every single green space was fenced off in the days after the camp. There was BPD presence on campus. It was fear, and I think that is a sign of weakness. I think that's the gist of it. Is if you need riot police with in rows in their hundreds to arrest peaceful students, you're afraid. And simply the what that means for us is hope, and it means to keep going. That this is the start of something that we have to keep fighting.
And I think that's a great place to end it. Going to ask you both to stick around for just 1 second, but Salcine, Patricio, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and for your bravery over the past few days and in the future.
Thank you.
And we are back. I hope you enjoyed the interview. And I don't, similar to last week, think it's appropriate for me to do my usual pitch. So what I'll say at this time is, if you are not following the Huskies for Free Palestine Instagram, please do that. They are keeping up to date with the current situation, and I'm sure that they will be posting ways that you can donate or be involved going on in the future. So direct you there. If you are looking for my work, it is all free, and that is over at patreon.com/bostopianews. And with that, I hope you take care, and as always, have a great rest of your day.